What progress have activists made in exposing the truth behind the September 11th attacks? Who is Leroy Hulsey, and what is unprecedented about his team's report on the collapse of World Trade Center 7? Is there a way of taking the 9/11 truth movement beyond education and awareness making to the halls of power, and what are the prospects for meaningful political change? What were the true motives behind America's 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, and what are the motives behind the recent escalation of that war effort? Why is it still relevant to expose the fraudulent nature of the war on terrorism 16 years after those devastating attacks? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of the anniversary of 9/11, we take a look at the movement seeking to expose the lies around the World Trade Center attacks, which supposedly triggered it, as well as the prospects that the 9/11 Truth Movement can make a difference in world affairs. Our guests for the hour are Richard Gage, AIA, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and Michelle Chosadovsky, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. On this week's program, does 9/11 still matter? Conversations with Richard Gage and Michelle Chosadovsky. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 8th, 2017. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. According to the figures, UK armed air missions in Syria rose by 480% in the first half of 2017 compared with the previous 6 months. However, rather surprisingly, in the light of the huge increase in missions in Syria, the vast majority of UK airstrikes continues to occur in Iraq, with 81% of UK missile and bombs dropped there in the first half of the year. Responses to our queries about this appear to indicate that this is due to UK aircraft deployed on missions inside Syria not launching their weapons there, but in Iraq on their return journey. UK weapons fired in Syria did increase by almost 50% from 79 in last 6 months of 2016 to 118 in first half of 2017. Figures show that the focus of UK Reaper drone operations also switched from Iraq to Syria in the first 6 months of 2017. That comes from the article, British Air and Drone Strikes in Iraq and Syria, UK Reaper Drone Ops, by Chris Cole, posted September 7th, originally appearing at Drone Wars UK. Far from saving lives in Syria, flying around between the US and Europe and collecting awards seems to be all that this group is doing. Last October, the White Helmets were also tipped to receive the Nobel Peace Prize, but apparently committee members backtracked at the last minute, instead giving the award to Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos. It wasn't long after that when the group scooped up an Oscar award for their Netflix documentary film. As one writer put it, quote, "Perhaps the only reason this group deserved to win an Oscar was for their acting skills, not their humanitarian efforts," unquote. This latest award should be seen for what it is, another ritual ceremony by the establishment to bolster the reputation of a failed construct, a carefully manufactured pseudo search and rescue NGO with very visible links to extremists, terrorist organizations, and under the umbrella of covert Western intelligence operations to destabilize the nation of Syria. That comes from the article, Tipperary's White Helmets Peace Prize, a Judas Kiss to the Anti-War Movement in Syria, by Patrick Henningsen, posted September 7th, originally appearing at 21st Century Wire. A new USA Today investigation reveals that top executives, lobbyists, and contractors are buying access to President Donald Trump through memberships at the president's numerous golf clubs, adding further concerns about the administration's ethical conflicts. Reacting to the story, one observer wrote on Twitter, quote, "In the developing world, this is called corruption," unquote. Membership lists of Trump's golf clubs are not publicly available, so USA Today tracked the names down through social media posts, news stories, and records on the U.S. Golf Association website, which show players' handicaps and scores. With those records, the news outlet found 4,500 names. That comes from the article, Golfing with Trump. Analysis reveals powerful elite can literally play for access, by Andrea Romanos. Postage September 7th, originally appearing at Common Dreams. Both the China-Russia economic cooperation and trade agreements, as well as their currencies being covered by gold, is part of a larger, already fairly advanced scheme of de-dollarization of their economies. In other words, Russia and China, as well as the entire Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, are rapidly moving out of the U.S. dollar hegemony. Let's face it, the entire Western monetary system is basically a fraud. It is privately made and privately owned, with the entire international payment system being controlled by the Fed, which is totally privately owned, and the BIS, Bank for International Settlement in Basel, Switzerland, also called the Central Bank of Central Banks. All international transfers and payments have to transit through Wall Street banks. That was from the transcript of an interview with Peter Koenig for Sputnik under the headline, Gold Trade Between Russia and China, a Step Closer Towards De-Dollarization, posted September 7th. Hezbollah swiftly defeated Daesh in an effective anti-terrorist campaign coordinated with the Syrian Arab Army along the mountainous Syrian-Lebanese border. Observers were taken aback by how quickly victory was attained, as the terrorist group has hitherto put up fierce resistance elsewhere in the country. This testifies to the growing strength of Hezbollah as one of the world's most effective anti-terrorist on-the-ground forces, as well as the relative weakening of Daesh as it approaches its dying days. Hezbollah's major victory against Daesh also sent strong signals to the three-headed Cerberus of Israel, the U.S., and Saudi Arabia, that the group is very capable of defending itself against all threats, and that its battle-hardened skills in Syria can also be used to defend their Lebanese homeland if it ever came under threat, once again by those three allied actors. Consequently, this means that their subversive plans against the resistance arc will have to be modified, since the strategy of expanding Daesh into Lebanon has clearly failed. That comes from the article, Unending War in Syria? Hezbollah won, but Israel won't stop supporting ISIS-Daesh, by Andrew Korybko, posted September 7th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This week marks the 16th anniversary of one of the most significant single events in world history, namely the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Scores of researchers have come forward in the intervening years and presented their evidence challenging the official story that Osama bin Laden and his band of co-conspirators managed to bamboozle the $40 billion a year intelligence apparatus of the United States and launch attacks that brought down three skyscrapers in New York City using two airplanes. These critiques have been around for as long as there has been a war on terrorism. However, just recently, a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks presented on a draft report from a team he is heading. This report promises to be groundbreaking and looks exclusively at the collapse of the third tower, World Trade Center 7. The report promises to discredit the authoritative analysis from the National Institute for Standards and Technology, or NIST. Here is an excerpt of what he had to say during his September 6th presentation.
Also in the NIST documentation, page 525, 2008, a girder was considered to have lost vertical support when its web was no longer supported by the bearing seat. That means the girder. That means if they're lost of bearing support on A2001 coming into the column 79, then it's lost. The bearing seat at column 79 was 11 inches wide. Thus, when the girder end at column 79 had been pushed laterally at least 5.5 inches, the web over, it was no longer supported by that bearing seat. NIST changed that 5.5 inches to 6.25 inches when it was shown that the seat was actually 12 inches wide. So that's kind of something to think about. Why did that happen? And that was later.
Well, to tell us more about the presentation of Leroy Halsey and some of the upcoming activities surrounding 9/11 truth and justice, we are joined once again by past guest Richard Gage. Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects. He's the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. AE911truth.org has the names of close to 3,000 now architects and engineers demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings on 9/11. Richard Gage, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
So first of all, I know that you've been involved with this research for more than a decade now, as I just indicated, and I know that you have already presented quite a lot of very compelling analysis that destroys or at least significantly challenges the official explanations that have been offered by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, NIST, and other the 9/11 Commission and other bodies. I'm wondering, though, what makes Professor Leroy Halsey's presentation distinct, unique? Why is this something that people who have been following your work for years, what is important about it that we really need to highlight it?
Well, he's doing a finite element analysis, and he's almost through with it. It's a two-year, $300,000 study. This is a very serious effort, one of the main flagship projects of the University of Alaska. And he's the chair of the Civil Engineering Department, one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country. And he looked at Building 7 coming down, and he was really curious about how that building could have fallen, according to NIST, by normal office fires. So here's a 47-story skyscraper that collapses in the afternoon of 9/11. Wasn't hit by an airplane. But after witnesses hear explosions, this building drops like a rock straight down uniformly, symmetrically, into its own footprint at free fall acceleration in under 7 seconds in the exact manner of a classic controlled demolition. So the effort by NIST to explain this as a result of office fires is ludicrous. And every architect and engineer who finds out about this building, and by the way, most of them do not even know because they're associations like the American Institute of Architects, the American Society of Civil Engineers, have not broadcast this building at all, even though it's the third worst structural failure in modern history. So Professor Halsey's effort at this scale in academia will take the academic and professional communities of engineers by storm. It'll turn it upside down, first making them aware that there was a skyscraper that allegedly fell by fire, and second, showing that it could not have fallen due to normal office fires. Every column, Professor Halsey said last night in his live-streamed progress report, he said that every column would have to have been severed at once. And so when asked how could that have happened, he says, I'll leave that up to your imagination.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that forward because I was actually very impressed by the professionalism, the technical details, and the dignity with which he presented this. It's hard for even a hater to look at that presentation and say, oh, this guy's a conspiracy lunatic, right? So, and he didn't use the words controlled demolition. He didn't talk about explosives, and for that matter, he didn't mention the collapse of the two twin towers. So, but was there anything about that presentation or what he has on the docket? Is this just a question of bringing real professional expertise to this question, or was there something in there that was novel or unique or that people didn't know about before?
Well, most people don't even know the building fell down, first of all, including, you know, most students across the country in engineering schools and professionals as well. So the whole thing was new to them, most of them. In addition to that, he went into great detail to show how at every step NIST had produced either fraudulent, consciously, or incompetent reports that all of their assumptions, or most of them, are not even to be believed. For instance, they said that there was no shear studs tying the floor slab to the girder. That was in question, that the long span beams through a new phenomena in fire destruction of buildings caused the thermal expansion of these 50-foot-long beams, pushing a girder off of its seat on this column, causing an internal progressive collapse, and then the vertical instability all the way up to the top, and then that travels laterally through the building. So he showed that none of that really could have happened, even if you assume NIST's faulty input data. So in the worst case, this building could not have fallen due to fire. And that's revealed also in his computer simulation comparison of NIST's computer model to the actual videos, which their computer model bears no resemblance to the actual videos. If there was such a cascading collapse like they said, you would have had massive perimeter structural steel deformation and breaking up of granite panels and windows and crumpling it like a beer can. None of that happens in reality, indicating that something else happened, which could only have been a pre-placed explosive synchronistically timed floor by floor, because the building falls exactly like those old hotels in Las Vegas that we've all seen. And that's why we have in Washington, D.C., the press conference on September 11th, Monday at 1 p.m. At the National Press Club, a presentation, an announcement of the Bobby McIlvain Act. Bobby was lost at the World Trade Center to explosions, which are not a part of the official story.
So could you just tell us a little bit more about that Bobby McIlvain Act?
Yeah, he's definitely one of the sponsoring family members of this act on behalf of his son and all family members who have not achieved justice or truth relative to the destruction of all three towers on 9/11. So this act requires Congress to begin an investigation of the destruction with the explosive evidence, the incendiary evidence of the Twin Towers and the Building 7, where even FEMA documented very carefully the hot sulfur corrosion attack, an attack of molten iron on the steel, the ends of the beams being evaporated, according to the author, Jonathan Barnett, a fire protection engineer. So this act incorporates this evidence, and we will take the act following this press conference to every member of Congress, 535 of them, and we have already have appointments with more than a dozen of them, Congress members and staffers. This is a very important effort in the 9/11 truth movement to bring about a real investigation. And we're looking for the conditions of support for a congressperson who will step out and take the heat, as we have in the 9/11 truth movement, for truth and for justice. And we can stop these needless wars in this $4.5 trillion war, global war on terrorism, which all goes back to the fraud of 9/11, because the evidence shows that the Twin Towers also were brought down by explosive demolition, as evidenced in the videos, where we have explosive isolated ejections at 200 feet per second below the point of jet plane impacts, with freely flying structural steel sections ejected laterally out of the Twin Towers at 60 to 80 miles an hour, landing 600 feet in every direction, with a complete pulverization of 90,000 tons of concrete in midair. Not that they're stacked up at the bottom in any fashion. There's no photos or videos that show that.
And so there's certainly on your on your website, for example, I think highlights a lot of these technical details that might change people's minds about that the official story. But just to drill down a little bit on the Bobby McIlvain Act and what you're demanding a new investigation. But I'm wondering though, I mean, for those of our listeners who get what you're talking, who visit your site and support your work, I can imagine that many of them would be skeptical of the success of this venture. And I'll tell you why. Just sort of a friendly argument, if I might. This idea that going to these politicians and asking them to present this and move it forward, because it seems to me that, you know, the implication of your work, I mean, you don't come out and say it, but you do ask the question, who had the means, motive, and opportunity to orchestrate these attacks? You know, who would have planted the explosion? So clearly there had to have been high-level state and military involvement. So I'm wondering, though, I mean, given that there's so much literally invested in the 9/11 narrative and this war on terrorism, I'm wondering, is it realistic to believe that Congress at the end of the day would vote in this act and deliver an authentic investigation as opposed to the kind of cover-up commission that we already saw? What do you say to that kind of skepticism?
It's a very fair skeptical question, because so far, 16 years later, we haven't found but one or two congresspersons who are not even in office at this time due to their outspoken nature. I'm referring to Cynthia McKinney, Ron Paul, others. Rand Paul may be helpful, and there may be a few others that are helpful. But we're not asking Congress to investigate. First of all, we're requiring them to investigate it. It is a posture of, here is the evidence. You're now held accountable, Congress, for the third time, because we brought this evidence to them when we had 1,000 architects and engineers, 2,000. Now we have nearly 3,000, and we have to hold Congress accountable. It's a law. It's a universal law. You can't just ignore the Constitution and the opportunities that have been given to us and fought for by our forefathers to bring this evidence to bear. We have to do what we can. And then, yes, maybe we don't have the level of trust right now, and maybe they don't have the level of support, those who are open-minded about it. But that will come. It is inevitable. There is a rise of patriotism in this country, a rise of the various truth movements who are due primarily to the opportunities given to us by the internet, are communicating with each other and educating others. So there will come a time when we can have enough people in Congress to make a difference, when the American people wake up. And I think that process has begun, and I'm very hopeful about it. It's not, it is not hopeless. It may not happen today. It may not happen next week or next year, but it will happen. And this is a process which is essential toward that end.
Richard, what other initiatives are you pursuing in order to achieve justice? I mean, going beyond the Bobby McIlvain Act, maybe months, years down the line, is there a larger game plan that you guys are pursuing, other strategies?
Our strategy is primarily to educate the American people, get into the mainstream media whenever we can. We have plenty of alternative media, well, not even enough of that, exposure. But we've done 600 radio interviews we've presented to over 550 audiences in 43 countries around the world, and we're not the only ones at AE 911 Truth. This is happening around the globe. It is it's like a swimming pool that you're filling in terms of metrics. You can't tell readily that we're, you know, over the ridge and ready to launch, but we've been building the awareness in the public unconscious that when it reaches a critical mass, will spring forward. So our strategies are primarily to not only educate the public, but the professionals as well. And that's where the Leroy Halsey study comes in. We expect that to be like wildfire in the engineering schools and communities. And we have a massive effort as a strategy to make them aware of it to the extent that they're not aware. And they may well listen to one of their own top forensic structural engineers, the chairperson of the civil engineering department in a major university. So, yes, that's our main strategy right now. But it's on all fronts, public, media, and academic and professional communities, as well as government.
Hmm. And maybe just one last thought. I mean, in terms of, you know, you mentioned that the $4.5 trillion war and so on. I'm just wondering to what extent these warmongers even need 9/11 anymore, because, I mean, we're still seeing, you know, a lot of like military belligerence towards North Korea and all of these, you know, the so-called terrorist attacks in Western Europe. I mean, is it possible that the war on terrorism has just taken on a life of its own and that we don't really need the 9/11 narrative to continue? Or is it would that breakthrough that you talk about really lead to a complete change in all aspects of foreign policy?
Well, I certainly believe, and those in the 9/11 Truth movement along with me, that the 9/11 Truth is a 2x4 over the head. Once people really get it, and a lot more people in the overall truth communities need to get it, it will knock over the rest of the dominoes, because when we realize we've been lied to at this scale, you know, not just that Iraq, we were lied to. Most people already agree with that lie. I mean, they know that we've been lied to about the reasons for going into Iraq, and they kind of just absorb it, but they can't still imagine that we've been lied to about the worst crime of the century and that it's been effectively covered up by the mainstream media for 80% of the public. So we certainly believe that that this issue, which spawned a $4.5 trillion global war on terror, the killing of 2 million people in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the invasion of four or five other countries, and the loss of our civil liberties through the Patriot Act, the Military Commission Act, all of that goes back to 9/11. So you pull the thread out from that lie, and the whole rug begins to come apart. So that's why I think it's extremely important that we all focus on the truth about 9/11. Beating people over the head, well, that hasn't been particularly effective. But, you know, just telling the truth out there, particularly with the credible evidence of 2,900 architects and engineers and our film, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out, which just pulls 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, controlled demolition experts, all laying out this evidence for the explosive destruction of all three towers. I think major things will happen all across the spectrum of these other false flag events and other conspiracies, if you will, aren't getting enough attention either.
Okay. Richard Gage, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Richard Gage, AIA. He's a San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects. He's the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And for more details about their work and research, you can visit the website ae911truth.org. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. I'm very privileged to have with us Professor Michel Chossudovsky. He's an award-winning author, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Ottawa, and he's the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order from 2003, America's War on Terrorism from 2005, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity from 2015. Professor Chossudovsky, I think a lot of people might argue it's hard to argue why it's relevant to continue looking at 9/11 truth and its consequences. Is that something? Why do you think we still have to continue to reveal and disclose the truth behind 9/11?
Well, I think 9/11 truth is fundamental because without 9/11 lies, so to speak, the global war on terrorism falls flat, okay? Because 9/11, in a sense, redefined U.S. military doctrine. It was in the wake of 9/11 that they launched the global war on terrorism. And the global war on terrorism has been the backbone of justifying military intervention in a large number of countries. While at the same time supporting the terrorists in Iraq and Syria and so on. So I think it is fundamental. And I think the geopolitics behind the 9/11 events are so important because right at the outset, on the morning of 9/11, in fact, it was at 11 o'clock in the morning, the Bush administration had already announced that al-Qaeda was responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But in fact, that assertion also implied that Afghanistan, so to speak, had attacked America. Because the following day, the Atlantic Council, the governing body of NATO, actually invoked the fact that a member state of the Atlantic Alliance had been attacked, and under the doctrine of collective security, all members of NATO would then stand in solidarity with the United States, and it was on that basis that they declared war on Afghanistan. Now, visibly, there were no Afghani jet fighters in the skies of New York that morning. And whatever the nature, whoever was responsible for the 9/11 attacks, it was really fiction to say that Afghanistan had attacked America. And then we recall that a few weeks later, on October 7th, the United States and its NATO allies waged war on Afghanistan, a war of retribution, under the doctrine of collective security. And that was total fabrication. And it justified waging a war on a sovereign country some thousands of miles away in Central Asia on the grounds that they were harboring bin Laden. Now, that was a lie, because, first of all, bin Laden on the 10th of September was in a Pakistani military hospital. How do we know that? Dan Rather, CBS News. He reported on that subsequently. His whereabouts were known. And then he did actually return to Afghanistan, and the Afghani government, the so-called Taliban, through diplomatic channels, advised their counterparts in Washington that said, if there's ample proof that bin Laden is behind these terrorist attacks, we will deliver bin Laden to the U.S. justice system. And that was done twice in the course of the month of September. And Bush responded by saying, we do not negotiate with terrorists. And so they dispelled the idea that Afghanistan would hand over bin Laden to the U.S. Judicial system, and they proceeded with war preparations launching a major theater war 4 weeks later on the 7th of October. And virtually every single military analyst knows that you cannot prepare a large-scale theater war several thousands of miles away in a matter of 4 weeks.
So the war was prepared before September 11th, obviously.
That war was prepared well in advance of September 11th.
So what was the actual aim of that war, if not to fight terrorists?
The aim of that war was conquest. Afghanistan is a geopolitical hub. First of all, it has tremendous resources, mineral resources. There's oil. There are pipelines. It's the gateway to Central Asia historically, and of course, Afghanistan also produced more than 90% of the world's supply of heroin, which is a multi-billion-dollar operation in its own right. And it's worth noting, I don't think that this was necessarily the only objective of that war, but the Taliban, with the support of the United Nations, implemented a drug eradication program, crop substitution, which led to a 90% fall in opium production in the year 2001. And immediately following the invasion, the levels of opium production gradually regained their historical levels, and they have increased something like 30 times since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001.
Sorry, so Professor Chasudovsky, I don't want to belabor the issue too much, but I think maybe our listeners need an understanding, and I know that that's probably a whole separate discussion, but what possible incentive would NATO countries have in allowing opium production to increase? Can you address that quickly?
Well, you know, opium is... The drug trade is a multi-billion dollar operation worldwide. It reaps tremendous amount of profit to not only to criminal syndicates but to the financial apparatus, to banking, where the narco dollars are deposited, and this is well understood and has been analyzed by many prominent scholars. Supporting a geopolitical agenda which endorses the drug trade is something which is well understood. We also have it in South America. Okay? But I'm not suggesting that was the casus belli. You have to look at the history of Afghanistan, and that war didn't start in 2001. It started in 1997 Reagan administration,
right? Operation Cyclone, I think.
Yeah. It goes back to the so-called Soviet Afghan War. That was a war in which the United States was heavily involved. So, and now we see the resurgence of that war with the Trump administration sending in troops. And the fact of the matter is that whole area of Central Asia is militarized. The objective is to establish military bases. The objective is to gain control over strategic raw materials, including lithium, which is it's the input into producing batteries. It has an impact on the energy market. There's natural gas. There's oil, it is also that area which which it's at, you know, we have to understand that Afghanistan is a border with China. Okay, it's very close to the former republics of the Soviet Union. It really is a geopolitical pivot, and Chinese interests are heavily involved in Afghanistan as part of the so-called the Belt and Road Initiative. So we're talking about conquest, occupation and conquest, because that is what has characterized all these wars since 2001, and of course before 2001. Mm-hmm. Libya, an oil economy, one of the largest or the second largest in Africa. Yemen, of course, very, very strategic. Syria, Iraq. These are the wars in which the United States is involved, and various other parts of the world. The menace against Venezuela, which is now has the largest oil reserves in the world. Admittedly, a large part of those are tar sands, but nonetheless, it is considered strategic. And underlying, to get back to 9/11, underlying the various wars in the Middle East is always the pretext of going after bin Laden or going after the terrorists. And the whole structure of U.S. military doctrine is the global war on terrorism. So that 9/11 truth is, to get back to 9/11 truth is fundamental. Mm-hmm. The official story is that the United States has been attacked by a foreign power or by terrorists. It's the same doctrine which has characterized the various attacks in Western European countries, including Barcelona, Manchester, and Brussels, that Western society is being threatened by an outside enemy, and that outside enemy is also the architect of the 9/11 attacks. Of course, all of this is fiction, but nonetheless, the media will uphold it and will deny the truth. That not only are the terrorists an instrument of conquest, they are the foot soldiers, but the whole idea of going after the terrorists is total fabrication. The objective is not to go after the terrorists. The objective is to undermine sovereign countries, destroy them, transform them into territories, and take over their resources.
I'm wondering if 16 years later, we've kind of moved beyond 9/11. I mean, do we even need 9/11, to be scared of this recent upsurgence in Islamic extremists in places like Barcelona and Manchester and so forth? Because, I mean, I think one could conceivably argue that, yes, 9/11 was, an inside job, that yes, that it was a fraudulent war on terrorism, but now we've got a kind of Frankenstein's monster in ISIS that, that it's like an unintended consequences or blowback. So if it is possible to believe that 9/11, that 9/11's narrative is phony and still support more war because we've got these unintended consequences, I wonder if 9/11 truth is able to retain its significance. I mean, talking about the collapse of the Twin Towers and all those other things. Could you address that?
But the logic of 9/11, or should I say the logic of the attacks in Brussels, Barcelona, etc., are very similar to the 9/11 attacks. Then they're false flags. I can say that with
I can say that because the governments of those countries are supportive of ISIS, and ISIS is an al-Qaeda-linked organization it's in terms of its history. And when the Spanish government says, or the Spanish media say that ISIS is behind the attacks because the U.S.-led coalition has driven them out of Syria and Iraq, hello, it's not these countries that have driven them out. It's the Syrians, the Iraqi resistance, and the support of Russia and Iran. Now, Russia has not been targeted by ISIS. Now, ISIS is supported by, we know that ISIS is covertly supported by the U.S. alliance. It's documented. We have official documents which prove it. So that it doesn't make sense for the Spanish government to say, or even for the media to say, well, the ISIS is striking back on us, retribution for what we did to them in Syria. We didn't do anything to them in Syria. We protected them. Okay, so the whole discourse is upside down, in as much as Al Qaeda is known to be an intelligence asset. Mm-hmm. Of the CIA, and that's well documented. The whole, the narrative simply does not hold. Neither the 9/11 narrative nor the narrative regarding these various attacks in Western European cities. It doesn't make sense. We know that those terrorist organizations are linked to U.S. intelligence. They're on the radar of law enforcement and intelligence in Western Europe. It's proven and documented practically in each of these attacks. Mm-hmm. So that these are false flags. Okay, they can be. The media is lying to us, and to say that this that and where of course 9/11 comes in is that each of these attacks is presented as an attack by an outside enemy, which is in Raqqa, Syria, or wherever, in Mosul. They're attacking us. We must then attack back. We justified that. We use this these attacks to justify a military intervention on humanitarian grounds in the Middle East. We justify it in view of waging a campaign of Islamophobia within Western European countries, which at the same time weakens any kind of anti-war movement. We haven't had an anti-war movement in the West since 2003. And why? Because the anti-war collectors will say, we're against the war, but we support the war on terrorism. But they don't dare to say that the war on terrorism is fake. Okay? The war on terrorism is fake. It can't be anything else because the terrorists are instruments of Western intelligence, not to mention Israel, which also supports the ISIS, al-Nusra, and the various al-Qaeda-affiliated entities.
Yeah, I know that your own research, this is what you've pioneered and others, but you've basically provided a bit of a bridge insofar as you maintain that the U.S. and other Western intelligence agencies have been supporting these Islamic extremists all along. And so you have a link there between, the 9/11 attacks and these what's been, we're seeing with the ISIS and these recent attacks in Europe. But I'm wondering if you have any reservations about aspects of the 9/11 truth that maybe don't pursue that approach. Like I say, we had a recent... right now there's an initiative afoot called the Bobby McIlvaine World Trade Center Investigation Act, in which you have activists trying to get a new investigation into 9/11, and it seems to mostly be revolved not so much on the geopolitics but on the mechanics of the destruction of the buildings. I wonder if you might wish to offer up an opinion as to that kind of approach of engaging these politicians to bring about a new investigation and where that's likely to head. Will it result in the kind of dismembering of a consensus that you seem to be focused on?
Well, I don't think we should ask the protagonists of the global war on terror to wage an investigation, okay? We have enough material to refute the official narrative, and what we need is a criminal investigation to start with, a criminal investigation to who brought down the towers. Now, look at tower number 7. It wasn't hit by an aircraft. It had a little bit of fire, and then, of course, the bringing down of that tower was announced 20 to 30 minutes before it actually occurred. There is a conspiracy there. How is it that CNN and the BBC knew that the tower was going to come down and reported on it while it was still there?
Well, I mean, the way this is going to play out, I mean, you know as well as I do that mainstream media, the bulk of mainstream media is owned, like I say, 90-95% are owned by 6 mega corporations, which are all literally invested in the 9/11 narrative and this war agenda. So it seems nonsensical to think that you're going to get any progress there. And I think likewise, the political system, any politician who speaks out is likely going to be facing a lot of challenges. So I'm wondering what apparatuses are at the disposal to get real justice, to get Dick Cheney and other conspirators thrown in jail. Is that a realistic outcome? I mean, people taking to the streets, which is what we're seeing right now, but...
It's not going to be. It's not going to happen when the protest movement is financed by Wall Street. And I think that's one aspect.
How do we get past that?
We have to start rebuilding mass movements. The anti-war movement in Canada, the United States, and Western Europe is dead, and it's dead precisely because. A, it's probably infiltrated, it's financed, and then people, don't want to go against this consensus. They said the consensus is that our countries are being attacked by terrorists. They don't want to go against that, okay? And they say, no, yes, we support the war on terrorism. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's been no real protest movement against the wars that... There's been no protest movement against the war in Syria, okay? And I know I belong to the collective here in Montreal, and the consensus is virtually to say no. This is a civil war. It's not a civil war, and when it's a civil war, you don't have an anti-war movement, and so we have to break that. It's a narrative, it's a lie, but people believe in the lie, or they feel they have to believe in the lie because the lie is a consensus.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to bring up one more point, and this has to do with, even if we should be successful in dismantling that consensus around the war on terrorism, what I'm looking at these days is saber-rattling at North Korea and China and Russia, which are not easily, synchronized with a fear of Islamic extremists. So, I mean, even if we do smash that consensus. What about this idea that Russia, that invaded Crimea and they interfered in the U.S. elections? I mean, I don't see 9/11 truth really dismantling and that idea.
Well,
so
fundamentally, we're dealing with media, with a media propaganda. We're dealing with a propaganda apparatus, which is very overwhelming and sophisticated. I've been following the situation in Korea. People don't know that 30% of the North Korean population was killed during the Korean War. Okay,
genocidal.
That is unprecedented. unprecedented in world history. And then they say, oh, they are a threat to our security. Well, we happen to have killed about 30% of their population.
So that basically that speaks to the idea of getting people to understand that the media, the mainstream media, is not their friend. And I think one thing that does seem to have changed since 2001 is a lot less confidence in mainstream media, and a growth of independent media, including your site, Global Research. So I just wondering if you had any parting comments about. Your site and its role in maybe some of the challenges that need to be overcome and how maybe our listeners can help.
Well, I mean, I think people are asking questions, but they're not really involved in any meaningful protest against U.S. imperialism, which is supported by media lies and fabrications. And of course, in more recent events, there's attempt to, in a sense, to undermine the online independent and alternative media through the manipulation of search engines and so on. That's another debate, but it's very, very significant. But what we have to start doing is to build a mass movement, which is grassroots, which is not supported by those who sponsor these wars and sponsor the terrorists, and the truth is fundamental. And once the lies becomes the truth, so to speak, because that's really what's happening, there's no moving backwards. We have to confront systematically the instruments of war propaganda, okay, which are distorting our understanding of what's happening. And then people might start rebuilding. But that's not an easy process. It's not an easy process. But 9/11 truth is still part of it. It's, as you mentioned, it's not the only thing, because there are other lies and fabrications. And there are other wars. There's Venezuela. There's South Sudan. There's Yemen. I think what we have to start looking into is a movement which confronts the U.S. imperial agenda, which is destructive in nature and which could potentially lead us into a World War III scenario.
Well, Professor Chostovsky, I wish we had more time, but we've just about run out now. So I want to thank you very much for your insights on this anniversary, and I hope we can have more conversations over the course of the next year.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Professor Michel Chostovsky. He's the director of the Center for Research on Globalization, founder of the site globalresearch.ca, and which is, as of September 9th, celebrating its 16th anniversary. For more analysis of 9/11 and the war on terrorism, be sure to visit globalresearch.ca, click the iBooks series tab, and then find the dossier under the heading 9/11 Reader. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.